You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
You know, I'm kind of tired and foggy-brained, but I've been keeping up with the news, so I can speak at slow velocity about that. In any event, you're young and vigorous, and you have unruly hair, which is good, which confirms that you're young and vigorous, and so you can carry us. I'm looking forward to this, and we're going to talk about a lot of stuff, I guess. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Nikita Petrov, member of the Non-Zero team, among other things, including proprietor of the Psychopolitica newsletter on Substack, which is wild. People are feeling too sedate. They should check in. Not a common problem these days, feeling too sedate. But still, if they are, that's the place to go. And one reason they're not feeling too sedate is probably the Iran war, which I think we're going to talk about. For some people, maybe another reason is that AI is kind of changing the world. Some people are not feeling that great about that. Some people are. We're going to talk about that. And ultimately, I'm going to draw a connection between those two. AI and the Iran war. You know, not enough is being made of that connection, I think. I don't mean like target selection and stuff like that. I mean, we're going to go deeper than that, Nikita. People come to us for depth, and they're going to
always go. We always go deeper than that.
Yeah, that's what we're about. And what else? What else are we going to talk about?
I can give you some updates on Russia. My wife is there right now. Spain here. You know, next week we're doing the Holy Week, Semana Santa. There is going to be the entire city is going to be turned into just parades with people in hoods carrying torches and heavy statues and. Work is just playing.
What are torches? You mean? Oh, torches. Okay.
Torches.
I was thinking, you know, I was already thinking ahead to people carrying the cross. And I know that, you know, in the Catholic tradition, the suffering of Christ on the cross is like a bigger deal than in Protestant religion. So I guess my mind went to torches.
There's a lot of Jesus on the cross and Virgin Mary. The thing that surprised me the most last year, I noticed it, is there's at least one of these days, like these parades are happening every day, and at least in one of them, some people are playing the part of Roman soldiers. So there are people carrying the statues, there are people carrying crosses, but then there's like a squad of people in Roman armor with the helmet and with
the
spear.
Did you try out for that part and not get it, or...
I think it's a long process to get there. You need to be a part of a brotherhood. I do have an app now. There's an app to track all of the parades that are happening, and it signifies which brotherhood is marching where and when and what their deal is. So this year I'm more prepared. I'm going to try to learn more about what is going on.
Maybe next year you can be a Roman soldier.
But it's interesting, like to imagine, like it didn't compute to me at first, like why, if you're a, you know, believing Christian and it's an important part of your life, to then embody the guard that is like helping the crucifixion of the god, that's an interesting position to be in.
Yeah, I guess they kind of cut you some slack. Somebody's got to play that role. I don't think you go to hell for that, but yeah, it must, you would think it's kind of awkward.
I think that's the idea is you share in the responsibility. Like, it's not somebody else crucified Jesus 2,000 years ago. It's all of us who did it.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, he was dying for our sins, according to Christian doctrine.
Right.
So we are all... So kind of the least you can do is be a despicable Roman for a day in exchange for the for the suffering that he endured. It's an amazing kind of... you know, theology or whatever, that I think was developed largely, at least to the extent that it's visible, that its evolution is visible, you know, by Paul in the aftermath of Jesus's death. And it was very appealing. You know, the idea that all of these sins had been accumulating and over time and finally Jesus came and absolved us of them, you know, paid our debt. You know, in a literal way. The other quick thing I'll say before we get to Ron is, like, I've always thought the icon of the cross is like the most elegant and efficient icon in the history of anything, because it's just two lines. You can't get simpler than that. And when you look at what it embodies this most appealing thing that, yes, you are a sinner, but, you know, the Son of God suffered on your behalf. So you are absolved of your sins. And that's one reason that worship is in order. So, like, the whole, you know, thing is so vividly reflected in two lines. That's that, I mean, and I don't want to, you know, be cynical, but that's good branding. I mean, that's...
No, in the history of logo design, that's definitely a highlight.
Yeah. So, enough about that. Iran, which some people think of as a religious war, I don't... Mm. I think that's one of the biggest and most dangerous confusions about wars, including Israel-Palestine, is to think of the fundamental driver as religious. But we are at a point where Trump is saying there's hope for peace. You know, in case anybody missed this week's action, he started by saying, in 48 hours, I'm going to devastate Iran's power plants unless they open the Strait of Hormuz. Everybody with half a brain knew there was no chance they were going to do that, and that if he did bomb the power plants, they would escalate along that dimension. And I don't know if Trump understood that when he made the threat, but anyway, he backed off and said, okay, you get another 4 days. Meanwhile, let me assure you, there's real action on the peace negotiation process, which Iran denied. A 15-point peace proposal, I guess, was leaked technically from the administration, which included some complete non-starters. Iran, a 5-point peace plan. Again, I don't think it was officially issued, but maybe it was. I'm not sure. That includes some non-starters. And so we'll see. I'm not optimistic, because, you know, Trump is involved, and he's just really bad at this kind of thing. I mean, you know, actual diplomacy.
I think it's also just true that ending wars is more difficult than starting them in some way. Like, I remember when the negotiations between the Russian and Ukrainian team started, you know, a month or something into the war. I remember that sigh of relief. Okay, they're talking, so hopefully they're going to figure it out in a few weeks. We're 4 years into this now.
Yeah. Now, one story there is that America and others maybe in the West were discouraging a deal that could have been had. That's one line. There's controversy over how
Boris
likely
Johnson
deal...
is brought up as the main villain there in that version of the narrative.
Or the messenger, at least. He showed up and said, wait, this isn't good enough. I think this was happening in Istanbul, maybe, but these negotiations. Yeah, and right now there are a lot of parties who don't want this to happen. Apparently, what's his name? Sean Hannity on Fox. He laid out his list of demands, what should be and what the U.S. should be demanding. And he said one of them is Iran must pay us back for the cost of the bombs we dropped on Iran. Okay? Now, I think it's going to be pretty hard for Iran to get the reparations they want. But for us to get reparations for bombing them, I don't know. I almost think you're trying to sabotage the negotiations when you suggest a demand like that. There's a lot of people who don't want this to happen, who don't want peace to happen. I'm not sure what Israel wants, actually, because as somebody pointed out on Twitter, they probably don't look forward to the idea of now that the line is so out there that Israel got us into this war, whatever you think about that line, it's prevalent. Israel probably doesn't want a lot of American soldiers to now die. And if they're, you know, if Trump is intent on opening up the Strait of Hormuz without some peace deal, he's going to have to put, you know, boots on the ground, probably big time. Unless there's just some kind of weird regime collapse, which could happen any day. God knows what ensues after that. But, you know, so maybe Israel really doesn't want that to happen if they're thinking clearly. So who knows what exactly they're agitating for? I mean, the trouble is, I don't think Trump understands, you know, cognitive empathy, understanding the point of view of others, I really don't think is his strength. And, look, in theory, it should be. If it's true, if he was qualified to write the book, The Art of the Deal, it should be a strength. Because if you're going to be good at getting deals, you do have to be good at understanding, like, what's going on. Like, if you're going to buy a car, you know, you do need to, it helps if you want to get the best deal, but get the deal done. It helps understand, like, is the salesman bullshitting when he says his sales manager just won't let him go, you know, below this price or not? The more you know about the perspective on the other side, the more likely you are to get the deal you want while still getting a deal and not get too ambitious. Trump just keeps getting too ambitious. You know, they got too ambitious before the war in terms of what they were looking for, I think. I mean, there was also the problem that he sent a couple of idiots, one of whom is his son-in-law, to do the negotiating. And they really didn't understand the technical context. But anyway, so on cognitive empathy, you know, he needs to understand, and I don't think he does, that his hand is weaker than it was before the war. You know, because the Iranians have demonstrated that they have this weapon, which is the ability to close the Strait of Hormuz and inflict other forms of damage on the global economy. And they're sticking with it. And these guys are more militant, more radical than the guys he killed, who used to be running Iran. And he's just gotta reckon with that. So when his list of demands includes, you know, no new uranium enrichment whatsoever. Well, as he may remember, they weren't willing to do that before. I mean, they're willing to, they were at least willing to give up, you know, to they've always said they're not going to get Obama. They've always been willing to do deals like the Obama deal that Trump trashed that would ensure that Iran didn't get a bomb. That's fine. But they've never been willing to completely end the enrichment of uranium. And if he thinks, like, although they wouldn't do that before the war, they will now, he is the opposite of comprehending the situation. Like, the terms he can get are worse, not better, than the terms he could have gotten before. Now, it may be suicidal for the regime to be insisting on those terms, but unless they start viewing their situation as much more precarious than they currently view it as, he's just got to reckon with that if he wants a deal. Otherwise, you want to open the strait? Okay, boots on the ground. Good luck.
Well, the U.S. and Israel have been pretty successful at murdering the people in charge, right? The high command. Just today, I think, just a few hours ago, I saw it's labeled as the official responsible for closing Hormuz was killed.
Yeah, it's kind of, I'll read, the Washington Post headline is kind of, well, darkly funny. Israel says it killed Iran's top naval commander in bid to reopen Strait of Hormuz. If Israel really thinks that's going to do the job, first of all, the Navy's not essential. You could wipe out the whole Navy. You could kill everyone in the Navy, and Iran could still close the Straits of Hormuz by firing drones from land that imperil tankers. And they don't even have to fire them from the shore, strictly. You know, they got some long-range drones. But just
they're importing
also,
drones from Russia too now.
Yeah, also, I mean, well, drones, they're making drones in places, you know, in various places. They're cheap, they're good at making them, and I'm sure Israel has wiped out some of the infrastructure and America and some of the missile making infrastructure and a lot of stuff. But the idea that killing this guy is going to open the Strait of Hormuz now. Will continuing to kill these guys lead the regime to collapse? That's possible. Because mm-hmm. I would think it might, for example, unless they figured out how Israel keeps finding these guys, if I were them, I would start wondering about how secure my communications are. And that might lead me to communicate less. You know, you can imagine kind of paralyzing the intra-regime communication. That would be significant if that happens. So there are ways the regime could, in effect, collapse, fall, be paralyzed.
What would happen then?
Probably just chaos. Probably nothing good from an actual U.S. Security standpoint, something bad for regional security and stability. Maybe something Trump could sell as a political victory. You know, but in general, all that kind of stuff, just chaos, civil war in Iran, blah, blah, blah. That is more appealing to Israel than to the U.S. Mm-hmm. from a national security perspective. I'm not sure if it's wise for Israel to find it appealing, but they think, you know, Bibi thinks that would be good. You know, better than an enduring and determined regime. And so we'll see. It's not good for, you know, could Trump sell that politically? I don't think he could turn the war into a win politically that way. I guess it would help him say we won if the regime's not around. But anyway, that could happen. The regime could collapse. But the idea of the regime agreeing to the kind of deal Trump is talking about, at least now, is like 0%.
Did you see the video where he talks about a gift that he got, a present?
He got a petroleum-based present, he said, and that gave him great hope. I think what I read somewhere is that Iran let a few ships through the Strait of Hormuz as an act of good faith or something, but they were not Israeli flagged or U.S. flagged. I think Iran insisted on that. That's what I read somewhere. I don't know if that's true, but you know, Trump, he's just so full of shit. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable that there's more than 1% of the American public who continues to take stuff he says seriously. It's just,
I find him weirdly, weirdly persuasive on a, like a hypnotist kind of level. Like, if I don't tune in and listen to him for a week or two, it starts to seem like everything's falling apart and that he's not in control of anything. It's just like chaos. And then I look at a clip and he's just so confident and he keeps repeating slogans and he keeps innovating on the slogans. Like, he has new catchphrases every few days, but he also builds on the old ones. And he's just so unfazed by anything. He's always just confident. He's winning, you know, he's almost getting tired of winning. And just emotionally, like without listening to the substance of what he's saying, just the degree of confidence, it rubs off on me. It's like I started to think like, yeah, maybe nothing can stop this person.
Nikita, that is one of the warning signs. You should seek therapy immediately. I mean,
like selling the war politically. Let's say the regime collapses and it's complete chaos and civil war and everything. And Trump, in his manner, says, we won. This was amazing. They're in shambles. America is the greatest power in the world. We just came in, destroyed them. We're out. It's not a forever war. I did the thing. Can that be persuasive to the voters that voted for him last time around?
Some portion of them, yeah. I mean, that, you know, for sure. Because he's been obviously full of shit for a total of, you know, more than 5 years as president. And you look at the ratings and there's still, you know, whatever poll you look at, there's still more than 35% of the people who approve. Now, the numbers are the worst they've been this term, right? Last time I looked, 2 days ago. At the Real Clear Politics aggregate favorability index, he was 15 points underwater, you know, the gap between approve and disapprove. And that's the worst. So this is not playing well right now. And this is a problem. This is the other big problem he faces. It's like the other problem with boots on the ground is it could go on a long time and we are already seeing the economic impact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be big. It's like, if it goes on long enough, because it isn't just the price of gas. I mean, think about food, okay? On the one hand, fertilizer, the price of fertilizer is already being affected. And it's the spring. Farmers are buying it. They may use less of it and get lower yields in 5 or 6 months, or it may go into the price of food. And then at the other end, packaging is petroleum-based. All the plastic that food is wrapped in is petroleum-based. And all the transportation involved in getting the food from the farmer to your table is petroleum-based, right? It's like, yeah, one way or another, there's almost certainly some carbon-based energy involved. And so if this goes on, I mean, if he magically ended it now, I think it would be basically a blip. But he's not going to do it today, mm-hmm. and I don't think he's going to do it in a week. And if he puts boots on the ground, we're talking about a long disruption of the global economy, unless, I guess, and look, if you put enough boots on the ground, you can probably get regime collapse pretty quickly. And I guess you can try to run the country if you send, I don't know how many troops you have to send though, and it's more than we got on the way now to really, you know, start running the country and saying everything's under control, all the policies are reversed, the Strait of Hormuz is open, and we can be sure that there are no stubborn IRGC elements anywhere firing drones at tankers in the Strait of Hormuz, anywhere in Iran. It's a big country. So I don't, if he really thinks he has bargaining leverage, that, I don't know. We'll see.
I saw an article. It's not very well sourced. It's by Mikhail Zygarydis, Russian journalist in the New York Times. He is writing, it's all a lot of, like, you know, widely considered or as rumors say, whatever. But he makes this argument that Putin had been warming up to the idea of treaty negotiations seriously and trying to wrap the war up because of the economic damage it's inflicting on Russia. And since the war in Iran, that's out of the window because the oil prices are up. Mm-hmm. The whole situation has changed. And so that hope for a change in how he sees the war in Ukraine has been eliminated by the war in Iran.
Oh, yeah. And there was a story today about us, I think, actually moving more resources from Ukraine to the Middle East or something. But in any event, obviously, the Ukrainian people are going to have significantly less protection against Russian missile and drone attacks than they would have if Trump hadn't started this war. There's been a huge diversion of resources. We pulled missile defense from South Korea for mm-hmm. this. And Iran is continuing to drain those resources. You know, the Pentagon talks about how, well, their strikes now are like, it's like at one, you know, at 4% of what they were originally. We've really degraded them. But if you look at the numbers, yeah, Iran responded pretty massively for 2 days. And then they reduced the rate and it has stayed constant. There's no ongoing degradation of the rate of Iranian missile and drone launches. It's been more or less a flat line for 3.5 weeks. And it's enough, you know, obviously, to cause exactly the kind of trouble Iran wants to cause. So maybe they'll run out of stuff. Who knows? And maybe more of their capacity will get degraded, but we'll see.
So how does that connect to AI? I'm
so glad you asked. I mean, we've already, and in Non-Zero, I wrote about this. You know, the issue of kind of Anthropic and targeting and the Pentagon clash and everything. I mean, that's kind of one thing. I don't think that's all that big. You know, could well be that reliance on these automated target selection systems did prevent the kind of human review that would have prevented the killing of those 150 or whatever schoolgirls on kind of day one. But no, just kind of more deeply, I was thinking, you know, I've been distracted by the war. I've been, my normal diet of heavily like AI and tech podcasts, which have been on partly because I've been writing this book on AI called The God Test, which will be out in a couple of months.
Available for pre-order, right?
It is available for pre-order.
Every author on every video where they mention the book that's available for pre-order say that pre-orders are extremely important because more books are getting printed if more pre-orders happen.
I think that's true. I mean, some news I heard from the people at my publisher is that pre-order appeals are less effective far in advance than they used to be. Like a year ago, they'd say, yeah, start talking about it a couple of months in advance. Now they'd say, sure, go ahead. But it's not going to lead to pre-orders until more like a month in advance, the way it used to, at least. But anyway, I encourage everyone out there to defy that claim. Make my publishers regret ever having said that. But yeah, so I started checking back into AI podcasts, and I was actually listening to Nathan Labenz's podcast, The Cognitive Revolution. And there was this kind of noted young genius AI watcher named Zvi Moshewitz. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. And they were just talking kind of like matter-of-factly, like almost, you know, the subtext was almost like, well, how near is the singularity? Is it 1 year or two? You know, but what they were, the actually explicit text was, where are we in the recursive self-improvement cycle? Recursive self-improvement is the, or spectrum, is, you know, in pure form, is the AI is just improving itself. You know, the humans, everybody at OpenAI is off at the beach. And the AI is just like improving itself. That's a extreme form of recursive self-improvement. But the less extreme forms have been happening for some time and are happening. It's happening more and more completely as the AI coding tools get better. And they are more, so more and more of the programming, the algorithm development is being done by AI. That is speeding things up. And it's gotten to the point, you know, where in their view, like, well, maybe Anthropic, because it's got pretty much the best coding tools, with maybe OpenAI a close second, just has a huge advantage because they're using their own coding tools. And certainly what they've got in-house is better than what they've released, I assume, to speed up their own progress. And so at this point, it's going to be very hard for anybody beyond kind of the top two or three, which is to say OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, to catch up. In this view, this is not a universal view among people who watch AI, but the point is these guys are not crazy. They're very smart, you know, both Nathan and Zvi, and they're talking about something that is accelerating right now. And I agree with both of them that it poses real perils, neither one of them, and I don't rule out the possibility that it could work out very well and we could be, you know, and lead to nirvana, but it poses real perils, and also I may disagree with one or both of them on the composition of the perils, which ones are more likely. There's the extreme doom scenario, you know, Skynet, it takes over, kills us, and then there's a whole range of things that are slightly less cinematic, but very much worth worrying about. And the connection I see is just like, my view is, I think more than a lot of people's in the field, maybe probably including Z's and a lot of others, is that if we do not confront this challenge as a global community, we're toast. It just can't be handled at the level of national policy, A, and B, the atmosphere of national arms race like us and China just increases the peril. So the whole, what you're seeing in Iran, which is just another fucking stupid war, started by politicians who just lie to us night and day. Although with Trump, you never know how much he, what's going on in his brain, how aware he is that almost nothing he says is true. Who knows? But, you know, just, and the whole tribal psychology by which it's so easy for both sides to enlist support in the average conflict. I mean, in a way, the Iranian regime's having a harder time because it went into this with a lot of popular discontent. But still, the number of Americans who just march in step, and it isn't just they respond to this particular thing. It's that, you know, for decades, America's media, I would say, has been biased in favor of the demonization of Iran, and that makes all this easier. And that's not unique. It gets back to Ukraine and Russia. We, beginning with the invasion, Americans were much better at seeing the Ukrainian perspective than the Russian perspective. And again, to say, please look at things from Vladimir Putin's point of view. The point isn't to get you to sympathize or to say his cause is right. It's to get you just to, for strategic purposes, understand, like, okay, well, what would it take to stop this war? What is realistic? That's what Trump is not doing, I think, with the Iranian regime right now. But anyway, it's just every time I see, like, the psychology of tribalism on parade in such spectacular fashion, I just think, oh, fuck, we're toast as far as the AI goes. Because it just, it can't go on like this. We're going to have to be...
Why does it have to be a global community to deal with AI? Why can't countries deal with it one at a time?
Well, there's just certain number of policy challenges can't be handled at the national level. I mean, the most obvious is AI is making it easier for small groups, even lone actors, to make bioweapons. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anthropic has basically admitted as much. They've already escalated to one level of their safety level protocol thing up to like 3. And now over the last year, they've said, well, maybe we should go up to 4. We're not sure. We won't do it for now, but obviously we're closer to 4 than we were a year ago, blah, blah, blah. And that's just the classic example of something where, you know, if a lethal epidemic breaks out, as COVID illustrated, it doesn't help America that it broke out in another country. Okay, so that's just almost a metaphor for a bunch of AI safety issues, up to including Skynet, right? I mean, if Skynet happens, it doesn't matter where the superintelligence developed, right? Where the superintelligent AI that went rogue, however it unfolds, there are various scenarios. If Skynet happens, all countries are toast, right? And then there's just a bunch of kind of intermediate things, like if a rogue AI, starts replicating wildly and infesting the global communications infrastructure and taking out satellites and shit, well, it doesn't matter where that started. If your satellites get taken out, if your communications system goes down, it doesn't matter where that AI started. And there's that. There's a bunch of issues like that. There's the fact that as an AI arms race between the U.S. and China heats up, and I don't mean just military arms. I just mean an AI race. You know, for reasons I won't go into, that's just inherently destabilizing and invites preemptive military strike by the side that worries that it's behind as some critical threshold gets approached by the other side. So it's just, I don't know, it's just, and almost nobody in the quote AI safety community really talks about this. Honestly, it's amazing. And a lot of them are these hawks. Like Zvi is a pretty good example, actually. He talks like more or less a China hawk, at least in the sense of saying, for the time being, our job is just to deny them the technology. And if somebody wants to say that and then say, and use that as leverage to do X, Y, and Z and reach some understanding involving AI, fine. But pretty much nobody in Silicon Valley ever says that part. They just say it's us against China. Don't give them the chips.
There's a so in Russia, one of the things that's happened, like actually an escalation that's kind of making more ripples than even the drone attacks, I think, though those are becoming more common. But I think a lot of people are taking them as, OK, that's part of the war reality. I guess that, you know, we, you know, Moscow for a while didn't have to worry about drones too much. Now it's becoming more of a problem, but it's been 4 years of war. So it's kind of understandable. But now there are two kind of lines of attack on the internet. On the one hand, the government is banning specific services, most recently Telegram, which is huge in Russia. And then that's after WhatsApp and FaceTime and all of these have already been banned. Though they like, it seems that their power to control this ebbs and flows. So like WhatsApp doesn't work 1 week and then next week you still can use it. But Telegram is working pretty poorly right now, unless you're using VPN, and even then it might be a problem. And then the other line of attack is just shutdowns, just no mobile internet in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, in Novosibirsk. My mother is there right now in Siberia. I know, like throughout Russia, multiple regions are struggling with this. And this latter one doesn't come with an explanation, not really. I mean, they say it has to do with safety, but they don't go further than that in explaining why the shutdowns are happening. And it's, you know, for businesses, not just personal communication, but for businesses, even, you know, your card reader when you're selling something at a store is becoming an issue. And then simultaneously, there is a bill that I think they... It's whatever, in what some stage of approval, and it should become law, I think, in 2027, about AI. And that introduces concepts of, I might butcher the words, but it's like sovereign AI system, national AI system, and something like trusted AI system. So maybe like China's DeepSeek, that's not sovereign. That's not something that we built and maintain here in the country. But you know, if it follows certain guidelines, and if more than a certain amount of users or some amount of traffic goes through it, then it has to be sort of landed, like the servers should be in the country. So they're developing this policy, this approach of trying to keep it in-house as much as possible and to control, and as much as they have to depend on other countries' technology, it's going to be selected countries and with agreement about how the technology needs to be altered to comply with the law, right? And so ChatGPT is probably not going to be available in Russia anytime soon.
No, in fact, they prefer DeepSeek, not just because of the source being China, unless, you know, distasteful to them than America, but because it's an open weights, open source model. So they can actually change it. Right. And make it, if they want to train it to you know, spout the Russian narrative on various historical issues, that's a lot easier to do with a model like that. But
is that whole approach, does that make sense to you in some way? Is it reasonable to some degree? Maybe like if it was coupled with, let's talk to other countries about how we treat this collectively, but you're sort of trying to develop your digital walls, your digital immune system, so that if Skynet does get developed in the US, we just shut everything down and like go into digital quarantine and build a sovereign internet.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you're hearing it a lot. I mean, the sovereign AI thing, we don't, in America, we don't hear much of this because we're America and we're the hegemon that other countries are worried about, right? The AI hegemon. And but you are hearing a lot of other countries say we don't want an AI that spouts the narrative of the hegemon and monitors us and blah blah blah. So you're hearing that. I think there's a lot of these things that it doesn't protect you against a lethal pandemic. It doesn't, it probably doesn't by itself protect your satellites or your this or your that. So it's not the, it's not, I don't think it's evidence that, yes, actually you can control your fate in the age of AI through national policy alone, but it's going to be an issue. It's understandable that nations would, you know, because these things are going to be very subtly influential. They may, you know, be the source of truth for more and more people. And so, and that's something that should concern us, right? Who is control? Who is deciding? You know, right now, they didn't even have to tell us what the training text was. I'd like to know. Shouldn't we at least get to know? Did they train on only right-wing foreign policy journals? I'd like to know. You know, I don't think they did in that case, but the point is, you deserve to know. I have a question about your the Russia thing before. We should probably go into overtime for long, but the shutdown of there were restrictions or whatever on Telegram and so on. Do you think, I mean, first of all, it must be in some sense a sign of insecurity, but my question is, do you think it's more about, for example, concern that the images of damage done by these drone strikes will get spread and people will have more of a sense that Russia's not winning the war? Or do you think it's about concerns about people actually organizing online to oppose the regime, or like none of the above?
I think probably all of the above a little bit. My understanding of what's going on with Telegram is what they would like to happen is not really to ban Telegram, but to get Telegram leadership to open it up for FSB, right? So if somebody is organizing a rally or spreading information they don't want to be spread, they want to have access to finding these people and prosecuting them.
So right now they can't use it as a tool of surveillance, and they want to be able to do that.
Right. Not as far as we know. There is always the battle between Telegram and the Russian government has been, I guess, since its inception, really, because Telegram is a project that Durov, the owner of the company, that's the project that he launched after the government took his previous one, VK Vkontakte. That was like a Facebook clone that was very popular in Russia. And he had a standoff with the FSB along the same lines where they wanted, it's a famous moment. They sent him a request to get him information on a particular VK group about like a rally gathering in Moscow or something like this. And he responded by sending a photo of a dog with its tongue out and no other comment. Long story short, his business does not belong to him anymore, and he does not live in Russia. He's in Dubai. But I think
out of the frying pan and into the fire, as they say. But anyway,
I think it's, I mean, he has like a case in, he was arrested in France, and I don't know where that stands now. Like there was a whole thing there. So I think, I mean, security services everywhere want more degree of a control over these apps. And in Russia, from what's going on, it looks like he didn't give them what they want. I think that's what's happening. They want, but then the other thing is there's a messenger they created, like a state messenger called Max, which they're trying to get people to use, and people don't want to use it. And so if you just ban every other app that is in existence and this one works, and maybe also with these internet shutdowns, there are like different ways to go about this. There's the blacklist, right? The apps that they're trying to prohibit from just being available from working. And then there is the other approach, which is the whitelist, which is if they shut everything down except for the government services, you know, whatever email accounts that they trust, and et cetera. So they could kind of play it one week after another differently. So they're trying to just have more control over this. But it backfires because Telegram is not only used by people to talk about shit and send memes and news and whatnot, but there is business in there. A lot of small businesses are, you know, it's ad revenue, it's selling products and stuff. There's media channels that are operating there that are, you know, part of the economy. And then the kind of weirdest part of this is the war effort relies on it too, to a certain extent. So when they first started banning it, the most noticeable backlash came from A, the soldiers themselves who are using it to communicate with one another, and B, the ecosystem of pro-war media and like volunteers, like people, what is it called? Raising funds to buy equipment for soldiers and, you know, being on the pro-war, pro-government side in the war debates. Telegram is where they make their living and where their whole operation is. And so when the government started banning that, suddenly they poked their own allies that are now becoming more pissed. So it's a touchy area. It's a painful area for the country right now. But they seem to be, you know, not backing down. And it's not like one thing. It's like it's a link in a chain. There is, as I said, as far as messengers go, all of these Western ones have been banned before. YouTube has been there doing slowing down and then banning. So sometimes it just works slowly. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. So they're trying to just sovereign internet. The Russian state-controlled internet is the goal, I think.
Okay, well, we should talk about this more in overtime, but we should probably head into overtime. I also, in overtime, want to talk about something else, or something you kind of touched on. Drone technology has, in a way, put Russia and the U.S. in kind of the same situation, or as opposed, we face some challenges with Iran that Russia faces with Ukraine, I would say, by virtue of drone technology. But and it's unclear to what extent this is like a long-term game changer in the very dynamics of war. But anyway, so overtime is available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes and below the YouTube video that will help you become one of those. You can just go to nonzero.org. And if you don't, you know, wind up reading any of the many worthwhile things to read there, you could just go straight to the post for this conversation, which is another way to access both this and the overtime. And if you're not a paid subscriber yet, become one. Anything else you want to accentuate that promotional message in any way, Nikita?
We could list things that we want to talk about in overtime if you have such a list. I want to ask you about ICE in airports. As kind of a continuation of, remember when the National Guard was being deployed to different cities where they were saying it was not supposed to be?
Yeah.
That gives me similar vibes. But I'll ask you in overtime.
Yeah, no, it's not unrelated to Iran either. I mean, Trump kind of like, you know, Minneapolis was a loss for him. And then he thought of Venezuela as a win and was hoping Iran was going to be. But yeah, we there's a lot of stuff to talk about. You just mentioned something that was a good example of that, but now I don't remember what it was. anyway, there's plenty of tech stuff, and a lot has happened in the tech world. Including in the AI world. Oh, Bill Maher was awarded Trump is going to give Bill Maher the Mark Twain Prize. And I will explain why Mark Twain would be rolling over in his grave. I just listened to a biography of Mark Twain and I've got the goods on this one. Okay. So anyway, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime in any event. We are going into overtime.